picking up sort of where we left off, the Hebrew writer has made his case for Jesus and his superiority in every kind of way. Better name because he's a king, better prophet, better priest, better covenant, better sacrifice. All of that has been established. And now he is engaging them at a practical level. They have been tempted to go back to the law of Moses. And he is essentially substituting something else. He says, don't go back to the law of Moses. That's inferior. But what you can go back to is you can go back to the faith of your fathers, because their faith is the very same kind of faith that you need to have in Jesus Christ. And their hope is the very same kind of hope that you need to have. And he's establishing that through all of these examples and really pointing out that faithfulness to Jesus Christ is not, from their perspective, of course, it seems like a new thing. It's kind of hard for us to imagine Christianity being conceived of as a new thing. But you think about Judaism. At this point, Judaism has been around for a millennium and a half. We think about in terms of Moses and people coming out. They've been around for about 1,500 years. Christianity has only been around for less than a generation, less than 40 years. And so this is probably, I would guess Hebrews is probably written sometime in the 60s, prior to the destruction of the temple anyway. And so Christianity seems like a new thing. But the Hebrew writer's making the point it's not a new thing at all. That they are entering into the same stream of faith and hope that goes all the way back beyond Moses. He's taking it all the way back to Abel and Abraham. And so they are entering into a tradition through faith in Christ Jesus that is as old as faithfulness. And so we've been looking at these examples. We spent a good bit of time looking at Abraham and Sarah, and some of the aspects of their faith is they are looking for something, trusting in something that is not seen. He makes the point that Abraham could have returned to the land where he came from if he was looking for a physical inheritance, a physical reward, but he doesn't do that. He was a sojourner in the land. And he believed in that which was not seen. Sarah likewise, when she conceived Isaac, Abraham trusted that God could raise Isaac from the dead. And we talked about that and sort of laid that over our faith in the resurrection of the dead. Of course, Abraham had much less reason to believe that, and yet he knew God, and so he trusted in that, even though that was not something that he had ever seen. And then we looked at Isaac, and we're in the process last time of looking at Jacob. And so I want to pick up there, we stopped in the middle of verse 21. Okay, and so we saw that Jacob, as he was dying, blessed each of the sons of Joseph, and worshipped, leaning on the top of his staff, and so. We talked about Genesis 47, 29 through 31, where he does, in fact, Let's go back there real quick. He does lean on his staff or worship at the head of his bed, verse 31, statement made there. And of course, his request in that passage in Genesis 47, his request is to be buried where? Yeah, in the land of promise, and specifically the cave at Machpelah, the burial site that Abraham had purchased. Okay, he has to buy a burial plot in this land. He doesn't have a single square foot to his name, and he has to buy a burial plot. But Abraham believed that God was going to give him what he promised, and now Jacob expresses faith in that same belief. And so even though he's living, we talked about last time, he's living in the greatest graveyard in the world, Egypt, with all its wonderful pyramids and all those sorts of things. He wants to go back and be buried in the cave at Machpelah because that is the land of promise. And so he's expressing his faith in God's promises and his hope in that which he cannot yet see. Now, the other way in which he does that is found in Genesis 48. And we're not going to just dig deeply into this text. If you want to do that, Alan is going to do that next quarter as he works much more slowly and carefully through Hebrews 11, talking about faith. But essentially what happens is Joseph finds out that his father is sick, and so he takes Manasseh and Ephraim, and he introduces them to Jacob, and Jacob adopts them. And if you notice, he says that they are going to be like Reuben and Simeon to me. And that's significant. That statement's made in verse 5 of Genesis 48. They'll be as Reuben and Simeon. That's significant because where are Reuben and Simeon in the birth order? They're first and second. Reuben is the firstborn, but he has lost his status as the firstborn. At this point in the Genesis narrative, he has lost his status because he went into his father's concubine. And Simeon and Levi are next in line, and they have lost their status because they slaughtered all the people of the city of Shechem because of the crimes of one man. You remember that the man Shechem had raped their sister Dinah, their full sister by their father and mother, and in consequence, they killed every man in the city, and so they are displaced. And so Judah would have been next in line, and in fact, Judah becomes the king, the tribe from which the king comes. That becomes the ruling family. But Ephraim and Manasseh are taken instead of Reuben and Simeon. Now, who's the oldest? I'll give you a hint. It's not Ephraim. Manasseh is the older, and yet who becomes the firstborn to Jacob? Ephraim. Ephraim becomes the firstborn, and he takes up Reuben's role. In fact, that I don't want to get too far off here, but real quickly, let's go to everybody's favorite passage in the Bible, the genealogies in 1 Chronicles. I know you've all been memorizing those diligently for sheer entertainment value. but they do have importance. Now, when you get to 1 Chronicles 5, the sons of Reuben, the firstborn of Israel, for he was the firstborn, but because he defiled his father's bed, his birthright was given to the sons of Joseph, the son of Israel, so that he is not enrolled in the genealogy according to the birthright. And so the birthright is given to the sons of Joseph. And in fact, when Jacob blesses Ephraim and Manasseh, he does this. He crosses his hands because they would have been brought to him by Joseph with the oldest at his right hand and the youngest at his left hand, the right hand being symbolic of strength. But he crosses his hands and he blesses the younger. And I'm bringing all this up because it's significant. Joseph takes great objection to this. And he says, no, this is not right. But he says, no, what I've done, it kind of says it is what it is. But he's entering into a long tradition here of the way God has done things. Because Abraham has Ishmael and Isaac. And who's the oldest? Ishmael, who receives the promises? Isaac. And then to Isaac are born Jacob and Esau. Who's the oldest? Esau. And who receives the promises? Jacob. And then to Jacob, the sons are born. We've already talked about his firstborn. But the firstborn to Jacob is actually the secondborn of the 11th born. Talk about being far removed. I mean, he wasn't even in the running. This is like winning the race when you didn't even show up and sit in the stands. Okay? He wasn't even around when Jacob's children were initially being born. And so he comes very late to the game. But the whole point of this, the second born, and then the second born of the 11th born, the whole point of this is it's God's gift. It's a gift of grace. And so Jacob is expressing that, conveying that in the way that he blesses them and expressing faith in the promises of God, that these promises are going to be realized in God's way through God's people. And so Ephraim becomes the firstborn. That's why later on, very often, the northern kingdom is referred to as Ephraim. Not sometimes Israel and sometimes Samaria, but very often Ephraim, because Ephraim is the firstborn. And so the chief among them. In the southern kingdom, obviously, Judah. And so, again, he expresses his faith in things that he could not see, was not going to see in his lifetime. He expresses faith in the land promise. He expresses faith in God realizing promises through his descendants, even though none of those things are presently evident and they're not even in the land anymore. They're living in Egypt. And so he's a great example of faith. Why else might Jacob be a really good example to these people? Does he sort of have a spotless record? He never made any mistakes, never did anything wrong, and you know, always right there, rock solid, acting in a way that is perpetually a glory to God, and maybe not so much. No, it's been rocky. It's been really rocky. So much so that I think his life, at least up to a certain point, and arguably even beyond that point, his life can be characterized as wrestling with God. Yes, he wants the promises. Yes, he's in a sense, he's after what God's after. But boy, he sure went about it in an awful way. And so it's rough. It's rocky. And again, the thing that recommends Jacob, and the reason that he's honing in on this part of his life, is because it shows that in the midst of a number of bad choices, and in the midst of a lot of tragedy in his life, he never quit. He continued to trust in God. He held on to the promises, and he never quit. And he overcame, in so many ways, he overcame those earlier mistakes in his life and held on to the promises of God. And that's exactly what the Hebrew writer wants his audience to do. His immediate audience and his more distant audience, that would be us. He wants us to hold on. Inevitably, we will do things that we regret, and certainly all of us have done things that we regret because we came to God through Christ because we were sinners. And so there's regret there, but that should not defeat us. What we need to do is we need to pick ourselves up and ask for forgiveness and move ahead and continue to trust in God. And Jacob had done that through a difficult and challenging life. And when he is asked to sort of summarize his life for Pharaoh, he describes his years as few and miserable. So it'd been tough. It hadn't been easy. And a lot of that difficulty, a lot of that pain, he brought down on his own head as a direct consequence of his own sinful choices. But he didn't ever quit. And that's the really important, significant thing here. Any thoughts about Jacob before we move on? Okay. So Joseph does the same thing, and they're not grouped together sort of accidentally, but he does exactly what Isaac and Jacob had done before him. When he's dying, he makes mention of the exodus of the sons of Israel and gave orders concerning his bones. And so, where is Joseph buried initially? Egypt. He's buried in Egypt. That's exactly right. But what does he say about his final internment, I guess we'll say it that way? That's right. He arranged for Kerr brothers. I didn't know they were Jewish. Are they Jewish? Okay. So that's right. He arranges for his bones to be brought out of Egypt. When the Israelites leave Egypt, he wants to go with them. And of course, he is expressing his faith in the promises of God. And that's the very thing. When he was dying, he made mention of the Exodus. The conditions in Joseph's time don't even reflect the conditions of the Exodus. That is, Joseph, throughout his life, is on good terms with the Egyptians, and yet God had told Abraham that his people would be slaves and they would be oppressed, and it would be a very dark and difficult time. Joseph hasn't seen any of that. He hasn't seen anything that the only part of that Joseph has seen specifically is, well, I guess there are two things. They're in Egypt. Okay, God had said they would end up in Egypt, and they did end up in Egypt. And so he's seen it that way. But he has also seen the broader promise of God for the nation play out in his own life, because he had been oppressed in Egypt and he had been delivered by God. And because of that, he continues to trust in the promises. And he expresses trust in those promises. And must necessarily believe. Let's consider this for just a minute. If Joseph is thinking this life is all there is, does it really matter where his bones end up? Is he going to care? I mean, I guess there could be some sort of sad sentimentality involved, but no, it's not going to matter. And so Joseph clearly thinks that real estate in Palestine is not the ultimate reward. That there is something, like Abraham, he's looking for something greater than that. And looking for deliverance greater than that. Okay, so let's move on to Moses. We're first confronted with Moses' parents in verse 23. By faith, Moses, when he was born, was hidden 3 months by his parents. And of course, the emphasis is on his parents, okay? Moses wasn't born saying, I think I'll hide for 3 months, okay? The emphasis is on his parents at this point. Because they saw he was a beautiful child and they were not afraid of the king's edict. And so, what do Moses' parents do? Yeah, it's interesting because they were supposed to, I guess, throw him in the water. But they put him in a basket. They station his sister there to sort of watch. And it looks like the whole thing was sort of conceived to set things up in such a way that Moses could be delivered by the Lord. And that, in fact, is what happens. And his mother becomes his wet nurse. And she's able to, in that role, apparently able to instill some sense of identity in him. But they trusted in the Lord, even though they're oppressed and there's a royal edict to expose the children to drown them. They didn't do that, and so Moses' life was preserved by the faith of his parents. And of course, they did all that not knowing. I mean, they couldn't have possibly known how it was going to turn out or what God would do, but they trusted that God would deliver Moses, and he did. Now, it says, by faith, Moses, when he had grown up, refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter, choosing rather to endure ill treatment with the people of God than to enjoy the passing pleasures of sin, considering the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures of Egypt, for he was looking to the reward. So what is the Hebrew writer referring to when it says he refused to be called the son of Pharaoh's daughter and chose to endure ill treatment with the people of God? What event is the Hebrew writer pointing to? Yes, exactly. Sorry. When he killed the Egyptian guard in Exodus 2, 11 through 14, Moses goes out among his people. It says, when he had grown up, he went out to his brethren. Okay, so Moses has a sense, he's living for a time, he's living in two worlds. There's a fork in the road here. Okay? And he can hang on to his identity as the son of Pharaoh's daughter. And he can live a life of ease and luxury and privilege. That's on the one hand. On the other hand, he knows where he came from. He knows that he is a Hebrew. And he knows that his people are being horribly oppressed. And so Moses, when he grows up, he goes out to his brethren and looked on their hard labors. And so he sees what they're going through. He sees their pain. And again, he stands at a fork in the road here. Because it would be pretty clear, be pretty obvious, that to associate himself with the Hebrews is not going to raise his stature in anybody's eyes. If he lumps himself in. Think about this. Think about you. You've grown up in the antebellum South, okay? Before the Civil War in the South, and you can choose to be black or white. Okay, well, you know, under those circumstances, choosing to be a black man in the South part of the Civil War, it's not going to go well. It's not, you're not inviting a good situation. And so that's essentially, Moses is standing at that fork in the road, and he can either be royalty or a slave. And he chooses to be a slave. And he rises up in Exodus 2. He rises up and he kills this Egyptian who has been beating one of his brothers. And he hides him. Now, the next day, he sees two of his brothers fighting. Okay? And he says to the offender, "Why are you striking your companion?" And that's when he finds out that it's known, and he flees. But he made his choice at that point. He is going to be with his people. Now, again, why would you do that? Well, the only motivation is to receive the reward. I mean, he's got rewards on both sides. He's got, on the one hand, he's got the promise of wealth and privilege and comfort, which is probably pretty well guaranteed. And it's right in front of him for his taking. Or he can associate himself with his people and probably pretty well be guaranteed not wealth and not privilege and not comfort immediately, but the promises of God ultimately. And that's the choice he makes. And that's why the Hebrew writer says that he chose to endure ill treatment and consider the reproach of Christ greater riches than the treasures of Egypt. Now, what does he mean, the reproach of Christ? How many Christians were there in Moses' day? Yes, exactly, none. So why does he say that Moses is choosing the reproach of Christ? What does that mean? This is sort of central to the Hebrew writer's argument, is why I'm bringing this out. Right. The suffering that Christ underwent was as a direct result, and the suffering that the people who are loyal to Christ undergo as a direct result is a direct result of being loyal to God instead of being loyal to men. And so it's the same kind of thing, okay? And that's the thing that the Hebrew writer wants to link in the minds of his audience. That the choices that these people made are the same kinds of choices you're faced with. Exactly the same kinds of choices. And so You can imagine that these Jewish Christians, they're looking at, okay, we could go back to the law of Moses. We could be accepted back into the fellowship of the synagogue. We could associate with our neighbors again. We could again do business and without fear of loss, and we could recover some of our financial reversals, and we could go back to a comfortable, easy life with some protections. And we wouldn't be an object of contempt and hatred. We wouldn't be suffering. We wouldn't be getting thrown into jail. All of that would go away. And things could be better. There's relief here. And so let's go back to Moses. And so the Hebrew writer, it's really a powerful sort of point, says, look, in your position, Moses chose to do the opposite of what you're doing. Moses wouldn't have gone back to Moses. Moses chose Christ. In a manner of speaking. Because he chose reproach, and he chose suffering, and he chose hardship because he chose God. He didn't choose comfort and ease. That was not where he staked his claim. He did this because he was looking to the reward. He was looking to the reward. Any thoughts or comments about that? Sort of that part of things? It was relatively long. Okay, I want to say maybe, and I don't know if this is consistent all across the history of, but I want to say maybe up to the age of four. And I hadn't thought about that in a long time. But their practice was not our practice. I mean, you know, we get them on something else much more quickly. But I think they prolonged. Anybody else know anything about how long Moses' mother might have been a wet nurse? Yeah. He concurs. Older than our practice, certainly. Almost certainly, yeah. And I don't know. We don't know when that relationship ended. She may have continued to have some role in his life. Certainly something was instilled in him, because he has a sense of this identity with God's people that when he becomes an adult comes to fruition. And so however that happened, it did happen. We see more of the results than the process, but okay. So the next thing we're told is that he left by faith. He left Egypt not fearing the wrath of the king, for he endured as seeing him who is unseen. By faith he kept the Passover and the sprinkling of the blood, so that he who destroyed the firstborn would not touch them. By faith he passed through the Red Sea as though they were passing through dry land, and the Egyptians, when they attempted it, were drowned. So when it says by faith he left Egypt, it's not, I think, referring to the time when he fled Egypt after he had killed the Egyptian overlord, because actually that time he left Egypt because of fear of the king. But It's talking about when he led the people out of Egypt. He is not fearing the wrath of the king. And of course, at that point, Pharaoh has told him to get out. But also at that point, Moses is well aware that Pharaoh's word doesn't mean a thing, because he has reversed himself over and over and over and over again. And he does again, as his heart became harder and harder and harder. He does again, but he leads the people out. Now, he's leading out a group of slaves. And so if we look at this from a physical, just earthly standpoint, is there any likelihood that the Israelites are going to be able to put up any kind of resistance to the armies of Egypt? Is that? No. No, they're going out and they're heavily laden and they're leading out flocks and they've got children and they're not armed, certainly not with chariots. No, they're in no position. This is a huge group of families traveling. They're in no position to resist the Egyptians. And so, and I'm confident they're not, certainly not unaware of that. When they see the Egyptians coming, they don't all sort of rally around Moses and say, we can take them. In fact, those words were never uttered by that generation of people. They were scared to death. By faith, he keeps the Passover. Now, think about that. Think about that. We want they're about to leave and they're told to kill a lamb and eat it and put the blood on the doorpost and the lintel, and that their firstborn will be spared. Of course, they've seen the plagues at this point, which certainly should have had an impact on them, and they've seen God make a distinction between what happens in Egypt and what happens in Goshen. But they haven't seen people struck dead like this, and yet, Moses kept the Passover and did all that so that the firstborn in Israel were in fact delivered, and he passes through the Red Sea again, which is an act of faith. They trusted that God would save them from their oppressors. Again, it's exactly parallel to what the Hebrew writer needs his audience to do. He needs them to trust God. And the other powerful part about this is it sort of, while he's looking at the faith of Moses, certainly in the background, it evokes that first generation that comes out and is not faithful. And we know what happened to them. Yeah, Moses trusted. Moses was faithful. What about all? No. So Moses seems to sort of represent a type of remnant. And then he jumps ahead, not surprisingly, to the time of Joshua. And he talks about the walls of Jericho. Now, When the Israelites sent in the spies, what report do they come back with in regard to the condition of the cities? They're walled, yeah. They're walled. We're not going to be able to take these cities. We're not going to be able to overcome their fortifications. And they also said, we're like grasshoppers in their sight. They're so big. And so one of their fears was these heavily fortified cities in Canaan. And so that generation doesn't obviously doesn't go in. The next generation does go in. They're going up against their first heavily fortified city in Jericho. And they have this brilliant tactical plan. They're going to walk around in circles until the fortifications fall down. Now, obviously, from a tactical standpoint, that's never going to work. You walk around in circles all you want. It might be really intimidating to the people inside for a little while. But that's never going to bring the walls down. And nothing in the experience of these people would suggest that walking around in circles brings walls down. They haven't seen anything like this before. And so all they have is the affirmation of God that an ill-equipped, untrained people will be able to overcome these heavily equipped, heavily trained people by walking around in circles. And yet, what did they do? They walked around in circles. They did exactly what God told them to do, and the walls came down. But the walls came down because God brought them down. I mean, they trusted in the promise that, you know, in many ways, before the fact, after the fact, it seems, yes, of course that's what happened. But before the fact, it must have seemed incredible. And yet they trusted in the promises. They trusted in that which they had not seen, which was outside their own experience. And they were able, in consequence, to defeat, again, a superior, from an earthly perspective, a superior force. And Christians must have looked at Rome, whether from a Jewish background or otherwise. And certainly Christians from a Jewish background must have looked at Rome and thought, you know, there's just no way that we could ever overcome. And, of course, it's not overcoming in a political or military form, but if they were, the Hebrew writer saying, if you'll trust in the promises of God, you absolutely can overcome. Ultimately, you can overcome. And so, again, this speaks directly to their situation. Now, related to this is Rahab. And Rahab is always a little bit problematic for us because of the lie that she told. And I think sometimes we focus so much on the lie she told, we forget about the truth she told. And a couple of truths, actually. Well, we'll have to forget about the truth she told until Wednesday, I guess. We'll pick up with Rahab. I want to spend some time thinking about that. And probably at least make a rough attempt at finishing Hebrews 11 on Wednesday. So